Welcome back to another episode of Law Schoolers talking about criminal procedure. In our last episode, we talked about exigent circumstances, and this is just a further discussion of our topic of full searches and seizures. We've talked about when you can conduct a full search and seizure. That's if you had probable cause and a warrant, or if you had probable cause and an exigent circumstance. This is our third and final topic about full searches and seizures, which is going to be consent. You can do a full search and seizure if the party consents, and actually most of the time parties consent. And you can do so even if you don't have probable cause. But it needs to be voluntary consent. Okay, so that's just really where we're at, where we're going to pick up off. We want to talk about two different topics related to this material. First, voluntary choice. Again, the consent needs to be voluntary. And then also, what happens if a third party consents for you? And those are going to be our main focuses on consent. Okay, so let's talk about voluntary choice. First case here is Schneckloth versus Bustamante. The police may search without a warrant if they obtain the voluntary, which means it's not coerced, or made by duress, as established by the totality of the circumstances, so that they obtain the voluntary consent of the subject. There's no need to inform the subject that they have the right to deny a search, and the prosecution has the burden of proof to show that there was a valid consent. Some of the factors to determine whether or not coercion was made in obtaining this consent is based on the totality of the circumstances. You're going to look at the age, you're going to look at the intellectual capacity or the sophistication of the person who is providing the consent. And then you're also going to look at whether or not that person has the knowledge that they can deny consent. This is not going to be determinative, though. Even if they don't have that knowledge, it's not going to make it or break it for the officers who obtain that consent. The right to deny consent cannot be waived because this is going to be different from trial. This is an informal interaction, meaning if you deny consent, well, then that is something that cannot be waived. You can always deny your consent, come back to it, that kind of thing. Then you have Ohio versus Robinette. In this case, the subject gave consent to a search of their vehicle after they were given a warning at a traffic stop. Was free will overborne at the time of the request of the consent? Ultimately, the answer is no. There's no need to inform the subject that the original stop was over before actually asking consent from this individual. But about 15 states that do say that the test should be more restrictive, which says that you should let them know, hey, the search is over before you actually get their consent to do a search. And then we have People versus Gomez. In this case, the police obtained consent from subjects during a traffic stop. Same usual thing. During the search, they found a suspicious hidden compartment. They opened it up. And now the question is whether or not the police went beyond the scope of consent by opening this hidden compartment. The test is what would a reasonable person have understood between the exchange with the officer. That's Florida versus Yamino. In this case, the police had exceeded the scope because they impaired the structural integrity of the vehicle and they left it in a materially different condition. Had they not left the vehicle in a materially different condition, and when I say this hidden apartment, they opened it, they pried it open with a crowbar. And because that altered the vehicle, it went beyond the scope of the search. Also, the search needs to be conducted as soon as reasonably possible. That's going to be the rule there, too. You can't just hold off after the consent has been given. It needs to be done pretty much ASAP, as long as reasonably possible. Okay, so that's voluntary consent, whether or not things are going to be coerced or whether or not you went beyond the search. You're just going to look at the totality of the circumstances to see whether or not it was voluntary. And there's no need to let people know and that a proper stop has been concluded. They can consent to it then, but you can't alter a vehicle if it's a proper traffic stop. Okay, let's talk about third-party consent. Consent may be provided by a third party if that third party gives the consent voluntarily, so same kind of standard there, and has the actual or apparent authority to do so. This actual or apparent authority is going to be shown by control, by shared control of the property that they are actually consenting to be searched. So we've got here Commonwealth versus Porter P. And we've got our definitions of actual and apparent authority. Actual authority is if there is a third party with common authority over a given area, they may give consent to that search. This is going to apply if you have a co-inhabitant or if there's a contractual provision giving the landlord any authority to consent to a search. Apparent authority, there will be a valid search if the police mistakenly but reasonably believe that the third party can consent. This must be a mistake about the facts, not about the law. In this situation, in this case, Porter P, there was a search of a... It's not a homeless shelter, but it's a shelter where families with very little to no money can stay as long as they abide by the rules. In this case, the officers, or rather the management of this place, suspected that Porter P had a gun, and so the officers were informed of this. Having a gun was a violation of this complex rules, and so the officers were invited to come over and conduct a search. The officers did come over, conduct a search, discover the weapon, and now it's just a matter of whether or not this needs to be excluded. So we're going to walk through this actual or apparent authority. Did the management have the actual or apparent authority to consent to the search of this place for the officers? First, there was no actual authority because the shelter director is not a co-inhabitant and there is no contractual provisions that allowed the management to consent. Instead, the contractual provisions only allow the director to call the police to assist in the search, but they can't expressly allow the police to search. Additionally, there was no apparent authority in this situation because the officers misunderstood the law rather than her position. The officers believed that they could search based off of the law, but they did not misunderstand her position. The dissent in this case does argue, though, that this is a poor policy. Asking the staff to engage in self-help is not smart, especially when it can be dangerous. There's a weapon involved. You're asking the staff to handle it themselves while the police stand idly by. That's not the smartest thing. And then additionally, the parties were in a position where the officers might as well conduct this search themselves. The officers were already called there. All that was left was for the officers to really just step in and do it in a safe manner. Okay, then we have In Re Welfare of DAG. So you have in this situation Dale and Thomas, who are roommates. They had some friends over, and their friends brought some illegal drugs, and Thomas, one of the roommates, objected. Thomas didn't want the drugs to be there, wanted those friends to leave, but when there was no change, meaning the drugs or the friends did not leave, Thomas went to the police and gave the consent to search the apartment. The police did come. They did a no-knock entry, and then they conducted a search and found the drugs. Here, in this situation, it's interesting. There was actual authority because Thomas was a co-tenant. However, when co-tenants are both present, they provide competing consent, meaning one consents and the other does not, the police are not allowed to search. And here, Adele was not given the opportunity to avoid consent because the police came without knocking and announcing. So, in this situation, the search was not valid. You can readily see how it could have been, but the police messed up, but not knocking and announcing. Instead, they should have knocked and announced, and Dell, also being present, should have given his consent. Thomas alone was not enough, even though he did have the actual authority to do so. Then you have State versus Schwartz. Here, the officers came to the door looking for the defendant, and the defendant wasn't there. Only a kid was present. This child was either 13 or 14 years old, and this child allowed the officers to enter the home and conduct a search. Here, again, the search is invalid because the child did not have the actual authority, meaning they did not have dominion over the home because of her age. Because of this reason, the search was invalid. It is important to note, though, in most states, a parent can consent to entering a child's room, even if the child is an adult. So if you've got a 19-year-old who's staying with mom and dad can consent to the officer searching that child's room. And then we have State versus Maristani. Here, the officers conducted a stop, and they removed and separated the occupants. When I say conducted a stop, I mean a traffic stop. They removed and separated them. Separately, the occupants provided inconsistent stories. So the officers asked the driver if he could search the trunk. The driver consented. Asked again if he could search the bags in the trunk. Again, the driver consented. In the bags, drugs were found, and the driver said that the bags were not his. Now, this is a motion to exclude the evidence found in those bags, the drugs found in those bags. The driver did not have actual authority because they were not his bags, but there was apparent authority because the police only need to establish a reasonable effort to establish the necessary facts. What's that mean? The police believed that the bags were the driver's bags. And for that reason, they only needed to establish reasonable efforts to make sure that those facts are there. It's in the driver's car. It's in the back of the trunk. The driver consented to the search of both. This evidence can be included. Okay, so that's our consent, our discussion on consent. Essentially, even if you don't have probable cause, you can consent to a search if that is made with the voluntary choice, meaning there's no coercion or duress. This is going to be established primarily by the age and intellectual capacity or sophistication of the subject who is being asked. Again, made by the totality of the circumstances. We talked about a couple of cases where traffic stops, you don't need to fully ask. You don't need to fully inform that the stop has finished before asking for consent. And then also, you can't damage vehicles. When it comes to third-party consent, you just need to see if the third party also gives consent voluntarily and has the actual or apparent authority to do so. Actual authority is there if the party is a co-inhabitant or there's a contractual provision providing the consent. Apparent authority is there if the police reasonably believe that the third party can consent, even if that is mistaken. And then we talked about a couple of examples where that's the case too. I do want to mention, though, if you are a co-tenant, even though you have the actual authority, if your other co-tenant is there, well, then that co-tenant also needs to give consent for a search to occur. And that's everything. And I will see you all later. Have a good one. Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Law Schoolers. Before I let you go, there are four things I want to say. The first thing is if you enjoyed these episodes and if you enjoyed the website, I would invite you to go and join Law Schoolers Pro, and you can do that by going to lawschoolers.com/join. It's a way for you to support us, but there's also a lot of features there that I think you will enjoy. Second thing is that nearly all of our episodes are unedited. The only ones that aren't are pre-law materials, and the reason for that is so you can actually see the legal material in its raw form as I'm learning it as well. The third thing is that the information contained in these episodes are specifically only for educational purposes. They're not to be used as legal advice. And with that, the fourth thing is if it is used as legal advice, we are not liable. That is, Law Schoolers is not liable for any legal outcomes. Thank you again for enjoying the show. Have a good one.